Discover Cambon Podcasts, conversations and audio documentaries imagined by Chanel that explore what inspires fashion, literature, cinema, dance, and savoir-faire. This series of rendezvous gathers artists and friends of the house. Listen to Cambon Podcasts at Chanel.com and on the streaming platforms.
Happy Saturday. It's November 1st, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your Airmail editors who are here to provide a break from the horrible news of the day and an immersion in the marvelous universe of Airmail. But first, here's what's happening this weekend. Michael Haney is running, that's right, people, the New York City Marathon tomorrow. Michael, tell us all about it.
First marathon, and it's a goal I've had for, came up with it, crazy goal, but I'll be running the streets of New York tomorrow, Sunday, November 2nd. So if you're here in New York City, come out, see, not just me, but it's one of the great days in New York City, 55,000 runners, the whole city comes out for it. It's pretty dramatic, pretty fun. I've always been out supporting it, and I thought, why not do it? I've lived in the city long enough, and I wanted to see it in this way. So excited to be out there and just, you know, come cheer on all the runners and have a great day in New York City.
Okay, what time do you have to get to Staten Island?
They have so many runners, they stagger the start times now. So they go from like 8:30, I think, with the elites all the way up until 11. And I'm in like the later one, 10:30 or so, because they've just got to get so many runners onto the course and they can't have a bottleneck at the beginning. So they've got a little bit later start time, which is a good thing and a bad thing. I'm used to running early. So, but it'll all be great.
And how are you going to celebrate after?
We have a table reserved at Jeans.
I mean, of course I should have known that. Why did I even ask? Right.
I was carbo loading last night at Via Carota, and I'll be sort of like topping it off the race night on Sunday night at Jeans, just so I can walk down the block, not too far.
A man after my own heart, carbo loading at Via Carota. Like, there's no other option if you live in Lower Manhattan as you do. It's perfect. All right. Well, best of luck. We can't wait to hear how it went. We're going to talk about it a lot next week. So now we should get to the issue. Another week and too many scandals to count. But one of our enduring favorites is back at it, Prince Andrew. He has now been officially stripped of his titles because William and Charles have had enough. He has also been asked to exit the Royal Lodge, where he lived rent-free, and he's going to be moving into a home of some sorts at Sandringham, which is the King's privately owned estate. What a fall from relative grace. He shall now be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, which, you know, as far as names go, is not half bad. And, you know, in his 70s, it does seem like a bit diminutive to be called a prince. Anyway, as always, Airmail is the antidote to all of the news of the day.
First, everyone knows that Donald Trump loves a lawsuit, but this week it seems he and Melania Trump specifically may have met their match in the journalist Michael Wolff. When Trump's lawyers threatened Wolff recently to sue him for $1 billion after he wrote a story alleging links between Jeffrey Epstein and Donald and Melania Trump, Wolff, rather than acquiesce, turned around and sued Melania for defamation in the hope that he'll get the Trumps on the stand under oath about Epstein and much more. And I'm Ryan Stu Heritage is going to bring us the blow-by-blow of what's to come. Then, speaking of trials and convictions, this past week, former President Nicolas Sarkozy reported to prison for a 5-year term after he was convicted of criminal conspiracy in a scheme to finance his 2011 election campaign. Our colleague Alexandra Marshall is going to join us from France with her report. And finally, it's not all bad behavior here at Morning Meeting. We've got a lovely story this week on one of the bright stars of Hollywood, Julie Andrews. And the writer Todd James Pierce is going to stop by to tell us how she got the role of Mary Poppins and was instrumental in the creation of that wonderful song, A Spoonful of Sugar. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Let's talk about the latest legal battles involving Melania Trump, of all people. Stu Heritage, who's a writer at large at Airmail, is here to introduce us to the great conflict of our times, Melania Trump versus the journalist Michael Wolff. Welcome, Stu.
Hello.
So, Stu, until recently, we thought the thing that Melania Trump hated most in the world was Christmas and Christmas decorations. But now it turns out she might have a more human enemy in the form of Michael Wolff. What is going on?
Oh, it's really exciting. There's lawsuits and counter-lawsuits going all over the place. As everyone is probably aware, the Trump response to any sort of perceived slight is to just threaten lawsuits everywhere. And that's what's happened recently when a number of people made claimed links between Melania Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. The response was just blanket kind of threats of lawsuits, of, you know, huge lawsuits. A lot of the outlets that made these claims or repeated these claims have taken down their articles and they've printed retractions and apologies. And there's a book, Andrew Lowney's book about Prince Andrew. The American version had to have a lot of it removed because it mentioned links between Melania and Jeffrey Epstein. But one person has pushed back against it. Michael Wolff has countersued from, not even countersued, they only threatened to sue him. So, but he's suing Melania Trump for defamation, and it's getting very sort of tasty, I believe you could say.
What do we know about the specific allegations that Wolf has made or the specific comments that he's made about Melania and Epstein?
This is the interesting thing. It's because he says that he's got 100 hours of interviews with Jeffrey Epstein that he recorded in the wake of a previous Trump book. I think possibly with an eye of writing an official biography of Jeffrey Epstein, which is a bizarre thing to think about these days. And the claims were, they range from the fairly innocuous ones like Donald Trump may have had a scalp reduction to cover up his baldness. But then it goes way into the first time that Donald and Melania Trump had sex was on the Epstein Lolita Express, his private jet. And they say that, you know, the marriage is a sham and stuff like that. And that's what caused Melania to threaten the lawsuit. And he's holding firm in such a sort of impressively brazen way. The filing that he sent in was, he just repeats all the claims as boldly as he can. So if people didn't know about them before, then they definitely know about them now.
I mean, how serious is Wolf taking these lawsuits and how does he intend to fight them?
His stated aim is that he wants to get Trump and Melania in court so he can interrogate them about their links to Jeffrey Epstein. But in terms of how he's going to fight them, he's been posting videos saying that it's likely he's going to do crowdfunding. You know, it's going to be a very, very expensive venture, I think, to take on the president and his wife in court.
Stu, it's pretty admirable, though. I mean, like, so many, as you note in your story, everyone else folds, sort of back away. And, you know, here is Wolf, you know, who's combative in the best way, always has been. And he also knows Trump, you know, has done monster bestsellers on the White House. So he certainly knows how Trump thinks, knows how to play that chess game with him. And here he is, like, when everyone else folds, sort of at least standing up and saying, like, you want to sue? Let's sue. Let's play the game. And as you say, get him into court and get him on stand, which would be insane if that actually happened, right?
It would be amazing. And it's incredible that he's done it, and, you know, more power to him. But it is, I think now it's just a game of chicken they're playing, that is who backs off first. And I guess, I don't know, if there was a crowdfunding campaign to make all this happen, I think I'd throw in a few pounds, dollars. We don't use coins anymore. I'd digitally transfer some money.
Who do you think is driving this? Do you think it was Melania driving it or Trump driving it? Or is it just she, like, say, like, you've got to do this? Like, is this the one that where it went too far for her and now she actually wants to sue?
Oh, I don't know. It does seem to be like the sore point. It's been the one thing that I can think of that's caused her to kind of throw threats around in the way that her husband does, kind of instinctively. It feels like it's a personal thing. Again, in the filing, there's this amazing paragraph. It says he wants to uncover what Trump and Epstein did during their 10 years of pursuing models, including supermodels, runway models, catalog models, Eastern European models, and girls who just dreamed of being models. The language in the filing is what really makes me happy, because he's not backing away from anything.
Yeah, it's what happens when you get a really good journalist writing the lawsuit and making sure he gets into the public record everything he wants to be quoted in the public record then, right?
Yes, and it's worked. It's brilliant. And I'm assuming it's, if you have 100 hours of interviews with Jeffrey Epstein, you don't just sit on them. So I assume there will be a book or something that comes from this. He's already sort of teasing it on Instagram. And I mean, if nothing else, this is just enormous publicity for that, I think.
You know, Stu, how much is this all going to cost? You know, because the legal fees, as we know, are exorbitant. And Michael Wolff is a successful journalist, but at the end of the day, just a journalist.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's written a lot of best-selling books, but he's going up against an army. So it's going to be cripplingly expensive, I'd imagine, and potentially ruinous. I think that just makes it all the braver that he's doing it.
Yeah, I would wonder if there's going to be any high-profile law firms that take it on.
If nothing else, it'll be a roller coaster to watch.
Stu, people are always asking me for the American perspective on UK politics, but I mean, just how crazy does this look to you?
Oh, it's bananas. It makes us feel good. It's like being the second drunkest at a party for us. Like, things are bad, but at least, you know, we're not you. It's strange to which, even in British newspapers, it's often the main story. is things that are going on in America, which is it's a baffling thing. But, you know, it makes good copy.
Stu, we're really happy we can keep you entertained.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Stu Heritage, have a great day.
Thank you very much.
I love this David and Goliath story, Michael. I'm not totally sure who's David and who's Goliath, though. These guys are both pretty bellicose, no?
Yeah, but if you think every politician doesn't have trouble at home or with their spouses, you got Nicolas Sarkozy in France on the other side with his wife.
Yeah, lesson of the day. It's never easy. Alexander Marshall, another writer at large for Airmail, is here to remind us exactly how Sarko ended up in jail and why his personality is one that we just simply can't shake. The fascination continues. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me on, you guys.
I mean, Alex, this story is so unbelievable that I have trouble even conceptualizing it. But as of this recording, Nicolas Sarkozy is sitting in prison in Paris. Is this actually true?
This is actually true. He's in the 14th arrondissement in a prison called La Santé. He is in a cell no bigger or smaller than the standard, according to an interview he did with Paris Match. That was really quite an eye-opener.
Yeah, and apparently he brought three books. Remind us of the books that he brought with him.
Yes. He brought The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, which you may remember is about a man who is wrongfully imprisoned. He brought a biography of Jesus, and he brought a collection of French poetry that was edited by former French president Georges Pompidou. So he hit all the excellent literary high notes for someone who's wanting to deeply signify through his lifestyle list. But this is what struck me so much about this incarceration and how it's playing out in the press, because it really does seem like it's a lifestyle story. Like Paris Match, you know, gave us the details on his cell, talked about the pictures that he was hanging in the cell, the few things he was allowed to bring, what his life was going to be like there. It just struck me that this man who's lived the greater part of his career, like really chasing the press, and his greatest friends in the press, Paris Match, continue to cover him with basically the same point of view as they have throughout his time in the public eye. It's really crazy to me.
I mean, we could be forgiven for forgetting exactly what landed him in this hot water, because there have been so many scandals over the course of his career in public life. So Alex, we can say like he had a complicated relationship with Libya, but he was accused at one point of using his platform to try to whitewash the reputation of Qaddafi, right?
Yes. And in exchange for that, he was apparently given money for his campaign, which is utterly and entirely illegal. Right after he was elected, the proof was in the pudding when he invited Muammar Gaddafi for a state visit, which he hadn't done for, I think, 35 years. He hadn't come to France. Gaddafi came with his all-female security guards, which was amazing, and set up a Bedouin tent at the Hotel Marigny, which is where, generally speaking, visiting dignitaries are put up. And apparently they grilled camel meat and had a barbecue. So that was a really quite a moment in the French press.
It was somewhat of a Baroque charge, right, Alex the Godhem? I mean, he basically is imprisoned because of criminal conspiracy related to this relationship with Gaddafi in Libya. That being said, unlike in the US, in France, if the democratic process is shown to have been manipulated by a foreign power, the judiciary is prepared to act, which is why Sarkozy is in prison, even though he's currently appealing those charges, right?
Yes, it was considered serious enough and there was enough proof to just put him in there. He was, just so we were clear, he was actually convicted of criminal conspiracy. So let's just make sure we're clear on that. But it was for that relationship and that set of acts before he, and right after he became president in 2007.
You know, this news has been met with much jubilation in France because Sarkozy, for all the friends that he had in the press, had also quite a few enemies. What was it about his personality and especially his relationship with money that so many found so intolerable?
Well, he was a self-made guy. His father was an ad exec, so he had some money, but he was essentially a self-made guy. He was a business and family lawyer who represented a lot of wealthy people and helped them kind of optimize their fortunes for the tax man. One of them was Arnaud Lagardère, who was the owner of a large media group, including Paris Match at the time. So he was flashy. He wore big fat Ray-Ban aviators and a Rolex, and he wore over his cuffs and he could show everybody that he had a fancy watch. He had a taste for the finer things in life.
But this is what's fascinating about him, like he's a complicated relationship, as Ashley notes, but it seems like the real crime in France is, like, is you've got this wonderful line in your story where you say, like, that it's okay to be rich in France, you just can't be flash about it. You just can't show it off, right? And here was a guy who, I guess there's a French term called, we adopt here, he's very bougie, right? I mean, flash, flash, flash. And that was seems to be like the more serious crime, even than taking this influence from Libya, isn't it?
It's funny, when he ran for president for a second time and lost to François Hollande, and one of the biggest appeals, and François Hollande, who was the big joke about François Hollande, the big nickname everyone gave him was Flambi, which is like a bland pudding. François Hollande was Mr. Normal and was able to win because the French public were so tired of Sarkozy's kind of press-chasing, blingy. He was on all the TV shows. He constantly arranged, we can't say for sure he arranged paparazzi shoots, but he did a lot to appeal to the paparazzi. He loved to go jogging and t-shirts that had, you know, he would wear an FDNY t-shirt when he was jogging in New York. He liked to do a lot of sport, and he was very aware of the cameras. Unlike Macron, who has an actual assigned photographer, at the time, Sarkozy just had strong relationships with PR people and with magazines, and was very open to being covered. When he came out, when he and Carla Bruni started their relationship, they finally came out by a quite clearly staged visit to Euro Disney with all of their kids. You know, they were not discreet. Meanwhile, of course, the relationship with Carla Bruni has lasted, and they do seem to be really in love. So as much as people thought that at the time that it was just for the press, and he wouldn't look like he was being cuckolded, and he got this, you know, amazing hot chick, so he must still be a man. In fact, their relationship has held strong, and they seem to be truly, actually really in love. She's really stood behind him in an almost unseemly way since his sentencing and his being incarcerated. She's really called into question the judiciary. She's really shown her teeth in a way that is unusual for France, which tends to be a little bit more stately when it comes to questioning the decisions of judges.
There's also no better way to get attention going into prison than to be walking hand in hand down the street into prison with Carla Bruni on your arm. So, you know, just again, bougie, bougie, bougie.
He started his incarceration a few days late because he was allowed to celebrate his daughter Julia's 14th birthday at the Hotel Georges V. And the press somehow managed to know about that and showed up with their cameras and took pictures. And it's really something to see Sarkozy, the condemned man, headed into jail, glad-handing people on the sidewalk as the paparazzi snap away. It's really a level of shamelessness that is kind of America didn't know either until Trump, really.
Well, Alex, thank you so much. It's a fascinating story, and I have a feeling we'll have a lot more to talk to you about as the Sarko story continues to unfold.
Well, let's see if he stays in jail, because remember, his appeal is still open. So if that actually goes through, then he'll walk right out of the pokey and back into, he's been judged ineligible to run for office for 5 years, I believe. But at least he'll go back to his groovy 16th arrondissement life with Carla and the kids. So we'll see.
I think the title of that chapter is The Sarkozy of Monte Cristo.
Or the Sarkozy of Monte Carlo, because...
There you go.
Oh, Monaco. Anyway, you guys, thanks so much for getting in touch.
Thanks. It was a great story. And I'm sure we'll be getting updates on it from you. So thanks, Alex.
Yeah, thank you. It was great talking to you guys.
Speaking of intriguing characters, there are few who are more beloved than Julie Andrews, especially when she emerged on the scene in such a big way in her role in Mary Poppins. Todd James Pierce is here to tell us all about how that classic film was made in his new book, Making Mary Poppins, The Sherman Brothers, Walt Disney, and the Creation of a Classic Film. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you very much.
You know, Todd, Mary Poppins has been in the public domain for so long that we feel like it's a part of the firmament, really, of American culture. But, I mean, it wasn't always a sure bet that this film would get made. Take us back. What was its origin story?
Yeah, so in the 1940s, Walt's interested in branching out more to live action and animated films. He does a number of these in the 1940s. So Dear to My Heart and A Song of the South, Three Caballeros. So he's looking for ways to diversify what is new studio in Burbank is able to do with elements of animation and elements of live action. But Pamela Travers is really resistant to handing over the rights to her film because she thinks it's going to be a saccharine Disney tale that doesn't represent her characters well on screen.
So who were some of the early pioneers of this project? Who was responsible for really getting it off the ground and into production?
So the people that really get this project going are two people that are known colloquially as the Sherman Brothers or the Boys. And so that's Robert and Richard Sherman, Dick and Bob. And so they're the people that really get this project moving forward. Walt Disney does not yet have the rights to make this movie. He has an agreement with Travers to do some development on it, but she's going to have to sign off on what it is that they've made. And so From the Sherman's perspective, they're given a very difficult task. One of them is mostly a lyricist and the other one is mostly the composer. And they're asked to develop the entire story for the film. If you've read the Mary Poppins books, they are what I would call bedtime short stories for kids. And so you can read one out loud in maybe 10 or 15 minutes, which is perfect when you're putting your kids to bed. But there's no global plot in the Mary Poppins stories. There's nothing that takes you from the beginning to the end of the first book. But what the Shermans have to do is they have to invent the larger plot that's going to tie together everything in the movie. They come up with a number of ideas, but they're mostly focused on trying to find what is going to hold all of this together. And they eventually settle on that this is going to be the story of the redemption of Mr. Banks.
So much of Mary Poppins' success is due to the prowess of its star, Julie Andrews. How was she discovered for this role?
She was discovered on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so some of the early considerations for Mary Poppins, I think, would have made a very different film. Betty Davis was someone that was knocked around in Walt's office for Mary Poppins, as was Mary Martin, who was a Broadway star. And I think she would have been reasonably good in the role. She turns Walt down. And so at this point, there's one other person that comes on the story team along with the Sherman Brothers, and that's a story artist named Don DeGrotte. And so they're searching around on TV and film mostly to figure out who's going to populate their cast. They also know that there's some pressure from P.L. Travers that the cast is going to be at least primarily British. They aren't all British, but Pamela would like them all to be British. And so one night on the Ed Sullivan Show, they see, and we're also back in an era where there were most cities had maybe three TV stations, three networks. And so there's a really good likelihood that your friends might be watching the same thing that you're watching. And so the Sherman Brothers are watching the Ed Sullivan Show, which is recorded in New York. And that night they see Julie Andrews on it. She's performing her role of Queen Guinevere from Camelot, which is on Broadway. And she sings What the Simple Folk Do, which also includes some whistling in it. The Sherman Brothers, each at their own house, see this. Then they call each other. And then the next day, they talked to Don DeGrotte at the studio, and they think that this is going to be at least a really good possibility for the actress who's going to play Mary Poppins. And they go and talk to Walt's secretary, Tommy Wilk, and she says, wait, Walt's not going to like this suggestion as much if you tell it to him as opposed to if he figures it out for himself. And so they put together a plan to get Walt tickets on his next trip to New York to go see Camelot with the hope that he's going to like Julie Andrews in this role as well. There's risk in this because Walt had a habit of giving away tickets. He'd be in New York, he'd have his meetings, he would decide he was tired, and he would give tickets to whoever he happened to be with if they wanted to go. He does go, and he does see that Julie Andrews, who I think is 26 when he sees her, would be a really good pick for this role. And so he meets her backstage, explains what Mary Poppins is going to be about. He tells her it's going to be different than the stories that Pamela Travers has written. And then, at least according to Julie Andrews, he acts out large sections of the film for her. This is what Walt was really good at the studio. He wasn't a good visual artist. He did draw some animation for really early Disney cartoons, but he was very gifted at understanding how story could be put together so that it affected kind of the center point of the American audience. And so he had a lot of practice at the studio acting out material from storyboards is what the Disney studio used more than scripts. So he would act this out. And so he acted it out for Julie Andrews. She thought that Walt was going to immediately turn her down when she told him that she was fairly early along in a pregnancy, which meant that they wouldn't be able to shoot for at least in the next year. And she was also at this time still hopeful that Jack Warner over at Warner Brothers would pick her up for her role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady, which was the role that she had originated on stage. He doesn't. He gets Audrey Hepburn to play that role instead. But that's kind of the setup for how Julie Andrews gets moved into the picture Mary Poppins that ultimately will transform her life and her career.
Todd, let's talk for a second. I mean, you know, one of the things that connects so much with people is, of course, the music and the songs. In your story this week, you know, you take us inside the creative process with the brothers and Mary and Diz and Walt, and how a song that never was sort of like in the mix early on, you know, which is probably one of the great classics of the genre, A Spoonful of Sugar, came to be because they had a problem. They couldn't solve it. They sort of, and how this song found its way into the movie and then found its way into our lives.
Yeah. So this was part of the Disney casting routine. Disney is not paying nearly as much for their actors as other studios are. So for My Fair Lady, Audrey Hepburn gets $1 million. Julie Andrews, who's new to the screen, gets $150,000 over at Disney. But they're also very open to creative contributions or criticisms from the actors in terms of how they'd like to play the roles. So there was a song called The Eyes of Love that Julie Andrews thought was too stiff, thought maybe was too direct. It announced the themes of her characters rather than suggesting them playfully. So she asked that song be removed and something else be put in its place. The song that's put in its place is going to be A Spoonful of Sugar. And so that's going to be a much more poetic way of talking about, here is something important that you need to take, but also a fun way to do it. And so Bob and Dick Sherman, they are now studio songwriters. They have a full-time job. The Disney studio, the main building in Burbank at this time, has three stories. Walt's on the top story. He has a whole suite of rooms to himself, and they're on the top story as well. And so they're working very, very close alongside of him, and they're trying to figure out how to make some sort of whimsical expression that's going to take the theme of Eyes of Love and then repurpose it in a little more upbeat song that Julie Andrews thinks will fit the character better as she would like to play it. And so Bob at home one night is talking to one of his kids who tells him that he has just had the polio vaccine. Then he is told how this was done. They put the medicine on sugar so it's not bitter, and then you eat it like that. And so he brings this idea to the studio the next day and talks to his brother Dick about it. Dick doesn't like it very much initially. He thinks it's too playful. But as he's out walking around the grounds, it's a lovely camp. It's about 60 acres. As he's out walking the grounds that day, he starts to warm to it. He builds it. And so that becomes the basis for A Spoonful of Sugar, which is one of the centerpiece classics from the film.
Well, Todd, thank you so much. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much for having me on. I very much appreciate it.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, Michael, so that's one movie we could watch this weekend, but I have a feeling, given all of the new television in store, you have some other recommendations for us.
I do. I continue to advocate for The Diplomat. If you haven't started that, dive in. You don't know what you're missing. Second of all, have you seen the new season of Nobody Wants This?
I've watched the first few episodes yesterday eating popcorn instead of paying attention to more pressing matters like my children. I feel very guilty about that, Michael, but yet I have no shame.
And thoughts?
Okay, so for me, the first season was more fun because I liked the meet cute romance story much better than the let's try to make it work story. But for some reason this season, I'm loving all of the supporting characters even more than Adam Brody and Kristen Bell. For me, Justine Lupe as Kristen Bell's sister is so hysterical and fun. Like, she steals almost every scene that she's in. And then, you know, I just I love all those guys.
Yeah, and I'm with you, Doug. The real life is such a drag. Give me the secondary characters. I'm with you. It was like a little kind of cringy watching them, but I love the second. So let's see where it goes. It's called Nobody Wants This. It's streaming now on Netflix. And I'm sure, Ashley, you've got something else.
I have Graydon to thank for this. I've been reading Carolyn Palmer's new book, Workhorse. Have you heard about this? She used to work at Vogue, and it's story
of a young magazine.
Yeah, I know. It's like another sort of Glory Days of Magazine story. But, you know, given that you and I both worked at Condé Nast during those Glory Days of Magazines, we can't help but go back there in our heads all the time anyway. So why not? This is a new book by Carolyn Palmer, who was an editor at Vogue. It's all about a young assistant who is climbing the ladder of success, and she divides her coworkers into two categories, workhorses and show ponies, basically. And it's a really fun, immersive read. She did a great job with it. You know, there's nothing I love more than what I would call finely wrought chick lit. And this is what it is for me. I mean, it's really well done.
All right. Good winter reading.
We want to wish you all a wonderful weekend. Michael, best of luck on the marathon. And we'd like to thank our sponsor, Chanel. It does not get much better than that. Michael, will you please read us out?
Absolutely. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our coders are Graydon Carter and Alessandra Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. Our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Rattel, and Ash Carter. Our CMO's Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and draw our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We'll be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.